This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
And Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
There he is. This week we have three main reviews for you. We're going to kick off with Hard Kill, starring Bruce Willis. Then we're going to go Norwegian in the Tunnel. And then we're going to meet with Nikolai Tesla in Tesla. Our short shot this week is Fanatico. And our DTV throwback is The Prophecy. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is Hard Kill. Mercenary Derek Miller is hired by billionaire Chalmers to provide protection for him while he scouts an abandoned building he intends to turn into a new manufacturing plant. He needs the protection because a terrorist known as the Pardoner is after a piece of cyber technology invented by Chalmers' daughter. Right, moving on to our next film. Jesus Christ, guys. I mean, you know, we try to fly the flag for DTV work. You know, for films that go direct to video, we try to tell people that, no, you know, these films are worth checking out. I know it's on the bottom shelf in Tesco's or Asda, but seriously, guys, give it a chance, please. You know, just pick it up and have a look. But no, we just cannot do that for this film. It is a turd of a film. You know me, I am Mr. Action. I love action movies. I hardly ever have a bad word to say about action movies at all. But, you know, and I kind of teased last week on Twitter, you know, I cited was it Time to Kill? What's the Jean-Claude one?
Kill 'em All?
No.
Kill 'em All. And Sniper Special Ops, the Seagal one, as being the nadir of action movies. Well, this joins those two at the bottom of the pile for me. I mean, starting off with just the worst version of In Media Res you could think of, because it was just nonsensical gunfight in the most nondescript location ever. You just couldn't tell why things were happening. No. Steve, please jump in here before I have an aneurysm.
It was terrible, to be fair. It made no sense. Bruce Willis, he wasn't even phoning it in, he was texting it in, he was that bad. The guy playing the Pardoner. Wow.
Oh, that whole bit where he goes, I bet you don't even realise why I'm called the Pardoner. And I'm like, no. He goes, the Pardoner's tale, you know, Geoffrey Chaucer, anyone? Geoffrey fucking Chaucer? Jesus Christ, I mean, how fucking pretentious. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
So that means he came up with his own nickname.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to put it out there. It made no sense. I mean, what the actual thing, the MacGuffin...
That never gets explained.
No, it doesn't. I'm not being funny. You give it at least an half-decent name. All the way through, they just called it, was it Project 725 or something like that?
Yeah.
And, no, it was like... kind of Assault on Precinct 13
done terribly.
Mm.
And it's like you're all in this building and you've got the bad guys trying to
sneak in through this ginnel thing every time. So you just wait there and shoot them as they walk in.
It was pointless. It was absolutely atrocious.
You're getting a bit muffled there, Steve.
All right, my glasses come off. There's not one decent
really redeeming feature of the whole film.
Do you know what really gets me with this? There were four writers involved in coming up with this.
One of them was called Joe Russo, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
And yeah. I was like, no, it's not that Joe Russo.
Not that Joe Russo.
I was going to say, please tell me it's not.
Four people. And I'm wondering if it came up with four people because I got a sneaking suspicion. What happened is that the director, Matt Eskandari, he's made three films with Bruce Willis now. He did Trauma Center, which I happen to enjoy. I thought that was actually not too bad. And Survive the Night, which I've heard reasonable things about. And I think he had an overall budget for all three films. And he spent most of it on the other two. And he had sort of about 200,000 quid knocking around for this. And so he had four writers doing their best to figure out how to spend as little money as possible to stretch out to 90 minutes or whatever it is. But Rich, we haven't even got to you yet. Please put the nail in the coffin here.
I don't think I disliked it as much as you, but I mean, it's definitely, it's the kind of movie you watch it and you just start to count the cliches and the conventions and stuff, and it kind of became fun for that, I thought. So I, as I was watching it, I'm sort of making up my own honest trailer as I'm going along. So it's like a gruff but troubled hero, a past his prime movie star looking for an easy payday, an elite team of soldiers for hire, including a pretty girl whose main character is trait is her hair and makeup, an abandoned building in the middle of nowhere, an ideological terrorist with a nickname, a meaningless plot about a MacGuffin called Project 725, a score to settle, obligatory gunfights and cliched stuff happening, hard kill. And that was amusing me, if nobody else. But the partner, his character kind of reminded me of Reynard, the James Bond villain from The World Is Not Enough, because he's kind of got this, he's the bad guy, but he sees himself as the good guy, kind of because of what he's doing is, he views it as noble. Jesse Metcalf as the lead, I thought was fine. He's got a really unusual look because he's really bulked out. I've probably never seen him as bulky as he is in this. But he's got that real proper, super handsome, kind of unsettlingly handsome kind of look to him. He's got, you know, sort of these eyes and stuff, and his beard and that. But he was okay. But the film, it starts with, like you say, that gunfight footage, which then goes into a bit where the bad guy has a meeting, with the girl or whatever. But they're two very nondescript kind of characters meeting in a very nondescript location, saying very sort of vague things. So the scene doesn't really, have any impact. And then we get several minutes of the hero basically stumbling around in his apartment before he gets called on this job, and they have to go out on the, he gets called out to meet Bruce Willis, who basically spends the majority of the film in various seated positions. He does have a couple of scenes where he's standing up. He's in it more than I expected. He pops up, regularly throughout. So more than like a Steven Seagal, probably. I thought, I didn't mind that so much. But when we've watched something like Money Plane, and you just see what the role can be, what the role could be.
Exactly. If you imagine Kelsey Grammer in that role,
it works a lot better.
Much better. But there you go. I just found this so generic.
I didn't mind the action though. When the action kicks in, and
it's not too bad. The sort of blood effects and everything are pretty well done. But
this is the thing: is hiding behind a wooden table whilst like subatomic, machine guns being shot at him, and it's blocking the bullets.
Yep, it's all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of the other conventions. So the young female scientist being taken hostage. That's like, how many times have we seen that?
You're a SEALs too.
Yeah, well, exactly. And what about and her elbowing the people holding her so that she can get away?
Yeah,
like that, and then running away. I'm sure
running away in heels. Yeah,
that's always how they get away. There's some, you know, there's some forced drama. So there's, you know, because Bruce Willis's character, it's her, his daughter who's created the thing, and so there's some animosity between them. So they try. So Bruce Willis gets like a big scene basically, where he gets to have a heart-to-heart-ish kind of conversation with his daughter, and try and seek forgiveness for his past sins. Oh, by the way, his character is not just the CEO of a very successful company called Chapter House, but he's also one of the toughest soldiers there ever was. Yeah. So I'm sure they wrote this because that's usually what they do with him. But the other drama is the fallen comrades thing, and there's like two of the people in the team, a brother and sister. Oh, what's going to happen?
Yeah,
it's like kind of thing.
And then it tries to instill some more drama by having sort of that betrayal moment, you know, as well.
And then there's like the noble conclusion. That's like, yeah, this isn't about the money anymore.
Oh God!
It's about the quantum AI that they've got to stop getting into the wrong hands.
Yeah. No, this was.
Talk about introducing something way much bigger than the budget. It's like, yeah, quantum AI. Yeah, it's so big you can't even conceive about it, and we're not even actually gonna.
It's so big we can't
try to explain it or do anything. We're just gonna say it. It's a thing.
Keep saying it. What does it do? What does it do? Why does he want it?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know, but no one can understand that. It's just the thing. It's cutting edge technology, man. You know, but in the wrong hands, it could be deadly.
They only say it so that it's in the trailer.
Probably.
Because then people will be like, ooh, that sounds interesting. Mm. And then it's like, you watch the film, it's like, oh, actually, no, they might as well have just said the rabbit's foot.
Yeah. They couldn't even come up with a car chase for this.
If they'd have done a car chase, it would have been probably the car chase from Escape Plan 2. You know, where it's just like that abandoned location, they just drive around the cars. I mean, like, nicely shot, but, you know, completely pointless car chase.
Indeed.
This is a location. The location in this film, which, funnily enough, does look a bit like the location from which is the art gallery in Money Heist, which we talked about in a previous episode. The location is just, like, the most isolated, abandoned area.
This is the most generic place.
Cheap. We won't need any extras. It's going to be great. It's like, we don't need any set design anything whatsoever. So apart from the fact that you've got a bunch of actors and, you know, there are some extras who are, you know, red shirts and that in it. It's just stuntmen being knocked around and stuff, really. And there's not a lot to... actually, you know, the other thing that came to mind was Universal Soldier Regeneration. When... Jean-Claude goes on his
killing spree. Yeah.
His killing spree bit at the end. They tried to do that, but with Jesse Metcalf, and I thought, you know, obviously it's not at all in the same league. Considering that's not what I would have expected Jesse Metcalf to be able to pull off, I thought he did all right in a couple of those bits.
Yeah, okay. It has its moments, but overall, this is just the most... I mean, I am literally saying this is the most generic,
very generic
thing I've seen ever, and there is no imagination gone into this whatsoever. It is literally we found a couple of $100K sitting behind the sofa. What should we do? Oh, let's go shoot the shit out of that abandoned factory.
Yeah,
that's basically it. That is literally it, and they found four people to come up with little bits of dialogue to slam together, you know, and a stupid MacGuffin which nobody bothers to explain.
But then they try to do this thing, you know, like when the title comes up at the beginning, they've got these little sounds like it's the Matrix. And it tries to be a techno thriller, but not actually fulfill on any of that promise. It's just like, yeah, we're just going to make these little sounds and stuff, but there's actually no technology in this film whatsoever.
It's come to that moment, guys. Scores on the doors. So, Steve?
Five. Straight down the middle.
Rich?
I had fun with the cliches and some of the action, so I'm going six.
I'm going three.
Ooh.
I'm going three for this one.
You're a harsh man. Imagine this was exactly the same movie, but we've got Kelsey Grammer delivering that sort of money heist kind of level performance in it. Everything else is the same. How would that change your score? What I'm saying is, how important is the Bruce Willis factor?
Well, this is the thing. He's not really a thing, you know. He's just a generic actor now. He's just someone who fills a role, you know. He doesn't bring any drama to it, really. You can say what you want about the sort of relationship between him and his daughter, but there's nothing there.
No, but do you think if you had a stronger performance from
Kelsey Grammer,
do you think that would have changed your score significantly, or do you think the overriding problem of all the
it's just too tough. Generic. It's just, I mean, it would bump up to a four or five if Kelsey Grammer was in there. Yeah. But overall, and I say this with, you know, being the biggest action fan on the planet, but this was just so generic, just so bland. So it's a three for me. So what do you say, Steve?
I have five. Yeah.
And a six from Rich. So quite a bit of a spread there from us on this one. Bit of a difference of opinion. I say approach with caution. You may get some entertainment value out of it. If you're a diehard Bruce Willis fan, then
Oh, what about the title, though? What about the title, about how generic the title is?
Oh, the whole thing.
Let's take the word hard and the word kill. Bruce Willis has already done a film called First Kill, and now he's done Hard Kill. And obviously the hard is trying to throw back to Die Hard. So instead of saying Die, it's like they could have called it Hard Die.
Yeah.
And the thing is about First Kill, I haven't seen it yet, but it's directed by Stephen C. Miller, who is a tried and tested, so, you know, he can deliver a good film despite the fact that Bruce Willis is in it. So, yeah, I'd be more inclined to watch First Kill than Hard Kill, that's for sure. Anyway, enough. We've wasted enough airwaves on this. If you want to check it out, go do so. Our next review is The Tunnel, set in Norway, this one. When a truck crashes inside a tunnel, people on their way home for Christmas are brutally trapped in a deadly fire. With a blizzard raging outside and the first responders struggling to get to the accident, it's every man for himself. Now, this starts with a very ominous bit of text, which basically says that, we have, you know, in Norway, we have lots of these accidents. And the general consensus is it's every man for himself. There's no set procedure. Mm. I'm like, oh,
you're on your own.
You're literally on your own, you know, which is pretty terrifying. So, as we've come to expect from sort of Scandinavian films, this is lovingly shot, that they really go out of their way to sort of showcase the stunning landscapes that they've got out there. And this ostensibly is set in and around a huge tunnel going through a mountain on its way to a fjord, which lasts about 3 miles, I think, isn't it? 3 or 4 miles, this tunnel? 5 miles, even, yeah. It's got a very long setup. I think it's sort of about 20, 25 minutes to really sort of get going as we meet all these sort of various characters. Our main character is a guy called Sten, who's a widower. He's got a teenage daughter. He's trying to, you know, bring her on board for, you know, his new fiance, but she's not having it. We've got other characters like the dispatcher at the rescue center, and the other sort of firemen and people like that, and people on this coach, and this family which get caught up in it all. So we need to be introduced to all these characters before we have this accident, and the ensuing sort of chaos that comes out of it. So it did take me a long time to get into this, I have to admit. And even after the accident, I'm sort of like, okay, you know. But I must admit, this grew on me as it went, or wore me down or something. And part of that is to do with the music and the way the sort of score builds up. It's just sort of this beat that keeps going and going and going, and it becomes a little bit faster, you know, a little bit more intense, you know, as the conversations like with the dispatcher and things sort of come out and they sort of realize what's going on in the tunnel. So by the end of it, I was actually sort of really involved in this. But Rich, what did you make of The Tunnel?
Norway's the new home of the disaster movie, it seems.
It is, yeah.
Because I think we've covered The Quake.
The Quake.
Recently, which came
and The Wave, yeah.
Last year, and that was a sequel to The Wave. And this is kind of an offshoot, because I guess those two were successful, so somebody else has gotten in the action, because this is unrelated. This isn't the third film in the series, although it could easily be mistaken for it. With a couple of changes, they could have easily... So we've had the Wave, The Quake, and now The Tunnel. So Norway is a pretty scary place, but very beautiful locations. Yeah, so the thing about this movie, compared to some of the other stuff, you know, we were looking at low-budget movies and, you know, these... you know, properly DTV kind of productions. This is a big budget cinema release kind of thing. It just happens to be, you know, not many Norwegian films get a cinema outing in the UK. And this was one that's, I mean, it'll be even harder at the moment with a lot of cinemas having been closed, but now open again. But this, I don't think was ever gonna, like The Quake, wasn't ever gonna see the inside of a cinema. But you know, we reap the benefits of that because I think it's just such a high quality film. Although, you know, it is very conventional. Again, like the, you know, it's a disaster movie. So it touches all the familiar beats. You know, there's actually not a lot apart from the landscape and that's very typically Norwegian. Then you've got subtitle on the language and I enjoy all that. But it is very much a standard. So if anybody remembers the Sylvester Stallone film Daylight, from about 1996.
Yeah.
Similar kind of setup, but not as action-y. That film had a lot more set pieces. This is quite, this is much more of an emphasis on the drama, I would say. Formulaic, well executed. You know, you got the guy, you know, introduced at the beginning and his daughter and all, there's a bit of a theme there, isn't there? with Hard Kill.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? There seems to be... It's a very sort of stereotypical kind of sort of father figure in these films, isn't it? You know, you never get sort of the wholesome family guy kind of thing. It's like, well, you know, he's already had some sort of hardships in his life and he's struggling with this drama with his daughter. And oh no, this has happened now on top of it. But yeah, it seems very sort of stereotypical, that sort of thing. Even with the likes of The Wave and The Quake, you know, you've got the guy who's sort of like on the cusp of...
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, we go back to The Wave and The Quake. So in The Wave, he had family difficulties, which, you know, the family unit is, you know, reconnected by the end of that movie. And then, of course, it's completely shattered again by the time the next film starts so that you can build...
Rebuild it all again, yeah.
I really... I mean, the lead guy is good. You know, he's got a hell of a beard on him.
Quite he is the most Norwegian guy that could come up with, isn't it? Yeah. Thorbjørn Haar plays Sten or Stein.
The one I really liked was his daughter, Elise. I thought she was great. Ylva Fuglerud, I can't pronounce that name, I'm afraid. Yeah. But yeah, she's really good. Strong performance. I'm going to throw it over now to Steve.
Yeah, I enjoyed this. Like you're saying, you mentioned Daylight. It's more of a down-to-earth, actual, how it may happen, rather than overblown Hollywood histrionics and stuff like that. And
yeah,
I thought the performance was great. The ending, yeah, was fun. It really, really enjoyed it. The only issue I've got with it was a couple of things that just didn't seem to be like subplots that weren't needed. Like the guy in the Tesla.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't go anywhere, does it? It's like they keep emphasizing it, and then it's almost like even though he's been completely divorced from the action, they keep cutting back to him. Because the highlight of, you know, the sort of payoff to all that is him them supposed to be going, hey, you've not been caught up in this terrible disaster. You should appreciate that you've got your, you know, your life intact and you're here with your son. You know, appreciate your son.
But he still misses his son's performance, doesn't he? It's sort of weird.
But they could have done that in like two scenes. They didn't need to keep cutting back to him. Yeah, yes, I understand that.
You know, with the long-haired hitchhiker that the guy didn't pick up, is it just to say, well, this is how
easily
it could have happened to you, or, you know, I don't know.
They don't do anything with that character, really. I mean, it's almost like pointless.
That bit baffled me slightly.
There's a lot of characters in the movie. There's so many things. But for the most part, I liked him. I thought all the performances and all the characters were really, really engaging.
Yeah. And, you know, there's one thing you mentioned there, Steve, as well. You know, it's very down to earth. It's not trying to sort of sell this fantastical sort of disaster scenario. This is probably I think it does mention at the beginning, sort of like, you know, this isn't a true story or anything, but it is based on things that have happened. I think it does, you know, there's this sort of bit of Schadenfreude element with one of the characters when he's sort of like, he switches the fans on full blast, you know. Which I thought the, you know, that particular ending was just like,
Chekhov's gun.
It is a little bit, it just reminded me of something stupid out of Family Guy or something. You know, it's just like sort of a punchline to a bad joke. But overall, I mean, I was in tears by the end of it. I don't mind saying, you know, the way things were going at the end, and the because I was, you know, the dispatcher lady who's, you know, at the sort of the disaster center, and you know, the fact that she's having to sort of take this phone call from these two little girls, you know, and then not knowing what's happened to them, you know, or basically sending Sten off to sort of go find them. Yeah, when he's basically saying, I'm dying here. But there's two little girls, go find them. Then, you know, which I thought was really cool. So, that sort of payoff at the end, I was like, I must admit. But I'm a big softy at times.
There's no dog that gets saved or anything in this.
There's a hamster. There's a hamster.
There is a hamster. His fate isn't quite as positive as dogs in most movies. But a lot of the stuff is quite, you know, designed to pull at the heartstrings and that. So you've got a family, you know, mother and father, two daughters. You know, they're caught up in it. It's kind of, you know, to a certain extent, some of it feels like Final Destination. You know, it's like like in Final Destination 2, everyone gets, you know, you see them and all that, you know, you meet all the different people, and then there's this big incident that brings them all together, which is the kind of standard disaster movie kind of thing. But yeah, I think when you say it's like down to earth, it reminded me of Mortal a few episodes back, you know, kind of that. You kind of got these, they're doing what Hollywood normally does, but they're doing it on a more limited scale. I mean, I know with the quake, we saw them sort of try and go big with a really big disaster, but this is a much more, you know, grounded, believable kind of situation. There's nothing too fantastical about it. I think you could find this very, I mean, there's certain aspects that are brought in. Is like, oh, it's massively snowy, you know, it's more snow than usual, and, you know, there's other things that are excessive for the situation. But for the most part, it feels quite... a standard situation.
I think there's a bit, isn't there, where they're sort of saying, well, all the main rescue equipment is at the other end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
You know, in this other village up the road. You know, it's their job to sort it all out.
I would say that I don't think what you were saying about the bit at the beginning and saying they're introducing this thing, and the, you know, if you're going through a tunnel, you're on your head, be it, you know, it's like you're on your own. But the film itself doesn't actually take that tack, because it's all about the emergency services and that going in.
That's right. This is just totally weird bit as well. The thing that causes the accident is this blue plastic bag, which blows up into the face of the onto the windscreen of the lorry.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, you see the bag just floating away outside the thing. And I'm thinking, is that bag evil? Possessed bag?
Well, that's good. Again where I sort of come back to this Final Destination thing, because that's kind of what they did. Because do you remember? Did you see the plastic bag in the first appearance? Several minutes before it hits the windscreen.
Yeah.
There's a scene when they're walking around in the tunnel or something, or somebody's coming, and the bag is on the ground and it blows up. Catches your eyes, and it's like, oh, you know, why are they focusing on that carrier bag? And it's like, oh, it's Chekhov's carrier bag.
That's like Chekhov's carrier bag. It's evil. But they should have just had some maniacal laughter over, you know, as it sort of floats away at the end.
You know what? I don't think anyone's done a killer carrier bag movie. I think
that'd be an interesting one.
Somebody needs to do that.
Interesting. Okay, guys, scores on the doors for the tunnel. Steve?
7.
Mm-hmm. Rich?
8 for me. Yeah, enjoyed this.
Yeah, I'm going to go with a 7. I did enjoy it, but as I said, I thought it did take a long time to get going. But once it did, you know, the drama and the tension was really good.
And you couldn't keep the tears away.
I couldn't keep it. I had something in my eye, but I just didn't know what it was. Yeah. But anyway, so 2 7s and an 8 for The Tunnel. Check it out. Our next feature review is Tesla, a contemporary look at the later life of Nikola Tesla and his rivalry with Thomas Edison. Now, Rich, I did not know what to expect out of this, I have to admit. I was relatively pleasantly surprised. It's got a great cast with the likes of Ethan Hawke playing Tesla and Kyle MacLachlan playing Edison and doing a bloody good job. I thought his scenes were really, really good. That monologue he gives at the beginning, I thought was really, really, really good. But the film is sort of narrated in an interesting way. And this could almost be like, it's almost like a school special, isn't it? You know, because you have the this female narrator sort of going, yeah, just Google him, and you'll see there's only four photos of him, you know, in existence or something, which I thought was just a really weird take on things. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the film's sort of broken up into these bits, and it's narrated all the way through, sort of explaining sort of the rivalry between Edison and Tesla, and, you know, the trials and tribulations both had, and the inventions they were coming up with, and all about Tesla's, you know, pushing for the use of alternate current, whereas Edison was sort of saying no, sort of direct current is the way to go forward. So yeah, this had me off kilter for a lot of it, I must admit. So, Rich, what did you think of this?
When it first started, I immediately got the impression that this film is not for everyone. And as it went on, I mean, I'm not sure about this. And I was almost feeling a bit guilty. I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have given this to Mike to force him to watch before we record and that. But I ended up being pleasantly surprised. It's got a very artistic temperament. It's an unconventional biopic in the truest sense of the word, because it just sort of goes in so many different directions. They a few things really stood out. There's, I mean, this, it's got kind of a lyrical feel to it. It starts with in media res, I think, and then it goes back, and there's a lot of exposition of talking about. I think it's his wife who's the character who's telling us all, or somebody he was involved with. He didn't seem to be romantically involved with her. I'm not sure.
No, I don't think it was his wife. I think it might have been his daughter.
He was like a business. He ended up getting the business partner of his business partner's daughter. Somebody he went to, right, eventually went to for money. And it's got this sort of strange feel to it. So there's certain scenes happen, and then they go, actually, this never really happened.
Oh, that was funny with the ice cream. Yeah, at the beginning.
Yeah, so you get this ice cream scene, which is really weird, and there's another, and there's one or two other scenes where they say actually, this was an imagined scene. This didn't really happen. Mm. And then there's one scene where it just introduces this synth wave, you know, wave kind of track that comes in to score one of the scenes, but at the same, you know, it feels like it's organic to the scene.
Yeah.
Like it's not like it's actually being music from the party or wherever they're going. So it's a very unusual approach of mixing the, you know, telling this story from the 1800s, but adding in this modern music. I know we've seen, you know, again, creative directors and that have done things like that before. Like, what was it? Sofia Coppola, I think, did it with Marie Antoinette. Was that
mixing? Yeah,
she
did. Mixing music. Yeah, go on.
No, it's just like that synth music, and then I don't know whether to mention it or not, but right at the end, when Tesla sings a song, sings a song. It's called sort of more like a talkie, or it's more like Sting speaking, but very very unexpected.
It's there's a bit in where I think he's in Pittsburgh. And you can hear sort of, you know, the sounds outside, but you can hear like modern day police sirens and stuff like this going on. So it was very, a very strange film overall. So you got Ethan Hawke playing, you know, he's quite sort of subdued in the role, isn't he? I think, you know, because, you know, the reckoning on Tesla was quite a sort of stoic kind of person.
He's very muted. He's not really, he's very... Yeah, he's almost almost passive, you know. It's like he's almost not even there at times.
But they do sort of, you know, they say, well, or his character says, you know, that he sort of spends so much time in his own head. having said that, sort of Karl McLachlan, I thought, was really good in this. He gets quite a lot to do sort of in terms of sort of speeches and things. And I thought he brought quite a bit to it. You know, he's sort of playing up the character's deafness and things. So, yeah, it's a very talky film, you know, but it's sort of, it's trying to bring to life a very sort of dry subject, really. You know, talking about patents and things like this.
Could you follow it?
Mostly, yeah. Recently we had the film The Current War with, was it Michael Shannon and Benedict Cumberbatch, I believe.
Did Tesla feature in that?
Yeah. That was the same sort of thing, but you know, more heavily dramatized and bigger budget. Whereas this, wasn't basically. This could have been a stage play. It really could. So overall, it's as you said, it's a weird one. It really is. But I think it does a fair job. And as I said, this would be something which possibly, you know, you might want to sort of consider giving to some school kids who have to sort of, you know, for a history test or something, you know, so you want to bone up a bit on Tesla and Edison.
Most people just know of Tesla as a car, I think, these days.
As a car, yeah. And, you know, yeah, David Barry playing him in The Prestige as well, so.
Of course he did, yes.
But it was okay. It was an interesting film to come across. It's not something I would have gone out of my way to watch if we weren't reviewing it. That's for sure. So,
have you seen any other directors' films before? So this is from Michael Almereyda.
I'm glad you did that.
Michael Almereyda. I'm gonna say. I think that's pronounced.
Say that. Okay. Let me have a quick look.
Because he's done films, he started out in the 90s, he did films like Nadia, which I think was a vampire, arty vampire film, and The Eternal with Christopher Walken. But then he went on, this is I think his third film with Ethan Hawke. He did Hamlet in 2000 and another one called Cymbeline in 2014, which was released over here as Anarchy, Ride or Die, which is a very different kind of
I've
way.
I've heard of it, but not seen it. Yeah.
But more recently, he did Marjorie Prime, which I know is also on Amazon. That was with John Hamm. He's done loads of stuff. A very sort of diverse director, but definitely with artistic leanings, it seems.
Yes.
And, after initially feeling quite, you know, put off, I ended up feeling, you know, it redrawn in and it feeling it being quite a hypnotic kind of experience of kind of following this rather dull character. And there's some interesting, you know, the way he's added in all these interesting stylistic choices and, you know, people being filmed in reflections, I think, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
To sort of, and putting the focus on some of the supporting characters, like say the, it being narrated, not by Tesla himself, but somebody who's observed him and is sort of commenting on it as if they were in the 21st century.
Yeah, in the present day. Yeah.
Google searches and stuff in the present day. Yeah. So it's I thought, yeah, this comes from Millennium Media, Millennium Films, who started out as like New Image and, you know, US Seals 2 and all that kind of stuff. And every now and again, they're a bit like Canon before them. They seem to back these really artistic productions like Bad Lieutenant, Werner Herzog's take on it and stuff. And I think in this case, it's paid off reasonably well. I think it's not bad. I can see why it's, you know, not managed to get cinema release.
Yes.
I think it will be hard to find an audience for this, to be honest. But I think...
on its star power, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. So what are you going to score it, Rich?
7 out of 10.
I'm going to give it a 6. I just want to sort of mention the cover to this as well, to the DVD image, which is using that sort of purple John Wick kind of colours again.
Yes, you're right. Yeah.
Which is a really, really bizarre choice, you know.
It looks like a musical.
You know, the text is written in a particular sort of way, but then you have the color scheme, which screams John Wick, and you got, you know, it's the guy with his back to the camera again, you know, I could almost imagine him with a gun, you know, if it had been sort of like a more sort of full image, he'd have had a gun in his hand, you know, looking at that picture. But yeah, that would have been funny. That would have been a hard sell, that would. But yeah, I'm going to give it a 6. Rich has given it a 7. It's got Ethan Hawke and Karl McLachlan in it. And they're both worthy of your time, that's for sure. Our short shot this week is Fanatico. When Sophia arrives at the Santa Maria Catholic boarding school for girls, she finds herself having vivid nightmares in which some of her classmates are being murdered. When it transpires that these girls have really disappeared, Sophia tries to warn her roommate Daria before it's too late. So this is heavily influenced by the giallo kind of films, the Italian thrillers, from the likes of Mario Bava and Dario Argento. So we have things like The Score, which is very heavily influenced by Goblin. And then we have, the black-gloved killer, the point of view shots and things like this going on as well. I thoroughly enjoyed this. I thought it was really, really good. It's low budget. The acting's not... You know, it's what you'd expect for a low-budget film. But overall, I thought it was really good. So, Rich, what did you make of this?
I liked it. I'm not a big fan of the giallo genre, but I could recognise the staples of, you know, the Suspiria kind of, you know, garish colours and the boarding school kind of setting and the... black gloves, cutthroat razor, and you know, there's a heroine who's, you know, perhaps seems psychic. But it's a 20 minute approximately, yep. 20 minute film. It's basically, it's not trying to do anything groundbreaking. It's kind of a love letter to the genre. Pretty well executed. I agree with you on the performances. That, you know, I like the lead heroine. I thought she was really suited. Mm-hmm. I like all the performances, but some of them are a bit ropier than others. The I really liked when the title credits came up, how they used the the titles came up as punctuation marks of like the bludgings.
Yes, yeah. Very well edited.
That sort of pulled me in. I thought it's definitely worth seeing.
Mm-hmm. Steve, what do you make of Fanatico?
Yeah, good, Rich, just to be fair. I mean, I'm not a big Jao fan, but like you say, you can definitely tell where it's coming from and what it's trying to do. And again, it's nice. Not nice. You know what I mean? It's well made. It's giving that cheaper look, I think it's supposed to be.
Mm.
You know, with a throwback. And same with the... was it Camp Calypso, was it?
Yeah, which we'll talk about shortly, yeah.
Yeah, so... yeah, no, I really enjoyed it. It's not different. It's definitely wearing its influences on its sleeve, and you know what's coming, and you know who the killer's going to be before it's revealed, to be fair.
It's It's the one thing that's kind of missing, and I did sort of mention this because I interviewed the director again, and I sort of mentioned that, you know, most sort of giallos would have a really twisted plot, you know, a twisted reveal sort of thing, and the sort of the motive would be just like totally out there as to why they're doing it. But, you know, I mean, in 20 minutes, what are you going to do, basically?
Yeah, exactly.
Personally, I thought the cinematography was great in this. You got that opening scene with the sort of neon lights and everything above them, and then when they're outside the church, I imagine it's quite difficult to sort of light this where all you can see is the outline of the characters. You know, it's dark, but they're sort of just lit so you can just see their outline, which I thought was very clever indeed. So this is by directed by Hannah Mae Cumming.
She was in her early 20s, I think, when she made it.
Yes, sort of fresh out of film school, basically. So her and her friend, or her roommate, Carly Boone, produced this, and Emma Cogan is the third member of the Monstrous Femme group of filmmakers who are looking to sort of put a feminist spin on sort of the horror genre, and they have a particular predilection for sort of 70s sort of set horrors, which I imagine what this is. I mean, it's pretty sort of idiosyncratic. You know, there's not much to sort of say what time period it's set in. I did like the fact they use this sort of old Porsche thing at the beginning, and one of the things I did like as well is the fact that, you know, they left the car where it was, and it was starting to accumulate parking tickets, which I thought was a nice touch as well, a nice bit of detail. But you know, there's not a huge sort of feminist slant to this, except for the fact that sort of three of the characters are sort of prostitutes by choice. These schoolgirls are, you know, schoolgirls by day, streetwalkers by night, sort of thing. Because, hey, it's a good way to make money. Basically, is the way they look at it. You know, they're not on drugs. They're not being coerced into it or something. You know, they have their own agency about it. So, you know, it's quite an interesting spin on that particular profession for this film. And there's a couple of little good jokes in it. When she has one of her visions, she sees her friend Daria with her face all bloodied, and then later on we find out actually no, it's just her sort of beauty mask, which happens to be red and then is dripping into the sink, which I thought was quite good. So yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this one. So this one we're going to put the film, a link to it in the footnotes. But we just want to sort of talk about another film of theirs called Camp Calypso, which is still in competition at the moment in various film festivals. So it's not available as yet, but it will be eventually. So this one is very much a sort of summer camp slasher movie in the vein of Friday the 13th and Sleepaway Camp and things like that, in which a young girl sort of finds out that the camp has a legend and a bit of a dark past. So, Rich, what did you make of Camp Calypso?
We've seen a lot of these, you know, slasher movie homages slash, you know, borderline spoofs. I think one of the ones we did a while back was Camp Blood 3. Did it,
in
Camp
2D.
Blood 3D in 2D, I think it's called. this is a positions better than that. I think, again, this is only like a 20-minute film. It's, you know, it touches on all the familiar conventions. Again, it's a love letter. It's very similar. The colours are also, you know, even though the first one was a giallo, so that was the reason for the colours being exaggerated. This is a different, you know, the kind of movie that's usually quite blandly shot as a rule. And this is, again, we got a lot of sort of heightened colours and things in there, which does give it a distinctive sort of tone and personality. It's comical, but without being a spoof. There's all the violence is similarly executed to the first film. So it's practical sort of, what did you say?
It's been
probably violent, you know, properly violent sort of, you know, blood and guts kind of stuff going on. Yep. And I think I preferred Fanatico out of the two. Mm-hmm. But it's still very, you know, very accomplished, you know, production for a group of young filmmakers.
Absolutely. Steve, what do you think of this?
I'd probably say I enjoyed it a bit more than Rich. It just really did capture that 80s camp horror essence, you know. Looks like it could have been filmed back then. It also kind of reminded me of what's it called?
Final Girls?
No. Wet Hot American Summer.
Oh right, yeah. I never did.
You know, that kind of
That
kind of.
And I know Josh used to really go on about that, didn't
he? Yeah, but a bit more, you know, obviously a bit more horror tinge and stuff, but that kind of throwback thing with the style and stuff. And I think when they've set out to capture the style of the giallo or the, you know, the camp horror, they've really, really connected well with it. They've really, it's not done as a spoof, but it's affectionate spoofing, if you know what I mean.
It comes out of love, not cynicism, basically.
Yeah, exactly. But they've done a real good job of it.
So again, you know, they're putting a bit of a feminist spin on things. So all the violence happens to the male counsellors at the thing. And, you know, in a couple of cases, you could say, well, in the first case, you could say, yeah, he kind of deserves it because he's literally on the verge of sexual assault. But the other two, okay, they're arseholes, possibly don't deserve to be murdered for it. But even so, the guys are arseholes and they're sort of asking for trouble.
Yeah.
The actor who plays the camp director, Pete, a guy called Derek Sweet, apparently he was brought in at the last minute. They lost their previous actor within like a week or so. I actually really liked him in this because, he brings this sort of sense of self-loathing to his character.
He's sleazy as fuck, isn't he?
Sleazy as fuck. But what was it? What I liked about it is that he could sort of join the dots, you know, because the film has flashbacks to what happened 15 years earlier when this guy was a counsellor and something that he did. And now he's there as the camp director now. And you can kind of join the dots of his life in those 15 years, you know, those missing 15 years. You can sort of see the shitty cycle of, you know, jobs he's probably done to end up back in the same place, which was quite interesting. So yeah, this sort of sleazy self-loathing sort of character I thought was quite good. And it has a very catchy theme tune as well. Mm.
I did like some of the music was really, it did really sort of jump out here, I thought. Mm.
Yeah, so the same composer did the previous one as well, or co-did the music. This one was actually co-directed by Carly and Hannah Mae Cumming as well. So, it'd be interesting to know who did what as far as those scenes were concerned. But I think, it bodes well for the future for them. I did another interview with these ladies, and I shall put a link to that as well as the Fanatico link and a link to the trailer for Calypso in the footnotes. So check them out. Our DTV throwback this week is The Prophecy. Thomas Daggett was once going to be ordained into the priesthood until he started having visions of a war being waged by angels in heaven. Now he's a hard-bitten police detective, and he finds himself being asked to take sides as the Archangel Gabriel is trying to kickstart the end of all things. Interesting film, this one, guys. Directed by Greg Wyden, who is probably best known otherwise as the writer for Highlander. And this sort of, you know, you can sort of see that sort of like sort of mythical elements sort of on display again here. A brilliant cast with, you know, the likes of Andreas Katsoulis and Eric Stoltz. Christopher Walken is amazing in this. And we even get an early performance from Viggo Mortensen and Virginia Madsen as well. So, yeah, a really sort of solid cast. Steve, what did you make of The Prophecy? Had you seen it before?
I thought I hadn't, but there were certain things, you know, when you're watching it and you're like, hang on, I remember this bit, and I can't remember all the desert-based stuff.
Yeah.
But none of the, like, religious bits and stuff like that. It was very strange when I was watching it, because I'm like, I remember the bits in the school.
Yeah.
But I don't remember Christopher Walker or anything like that. And but no, it's, I don't think it's particularly age well with the pacing.
True.
I think the pacing's quite slow in parts. Performances were good. Even, dare I say, the child was a little bit off. But you see, it's interesting. I mean, Viggo Mortensen was, oh, batshit crazy again, you know. Obviously playing the devil. Walken's amazing in it.
Yeah.
Eric Stoltz is a little bit flat. It, not so much flat. It's just he's not really giving much to do, to be fair.
No.
But then again, you don't realise how certain bits, how violent it is as well.
There are some really cool little moments in this. So people being thrown through car windshields and things.
Yeah.
Rich.
Yeah, overall not bad.
Richard, what do you think?
Yeah, I like this one. When it came out around, it was made in 95, I think it came out in 96. And it was one of those films that was kind of fated as one of the best films that should have had a cinema release, you know, kind of thing. As I remember reading about, you know, Empire was sort of praising it and stuff like that. And it's definitely deserved. I mean, it's a made for cinema movie, which was ironically followed by four DTV, you know, made for DTV sequels of diminishing quality. Because Christopher Walken only stuck around for two of them, and then the rest of the other two were, you know, didn't really have a lot going for them, to be honest. Because Christopher Walken is at the heart of this. He's like the pinhead of the Prophecy series. It's all hinged kind of on the strength of his performance. But in this one, you've got such a great supporting cast. The second one kind of goes into, you know, it's more of a retread of like the Terminator, but with Christopher Walken's character as the Terminator. But the this one, they introduce him really well. Walken, you know, it's typical Walken. He gets to be quite intimidating. He gets some monologues. He gets some, you know, gets these great lines like "I kill newborns while their mamas watch" and stuff like that, which, you know, really stick with you. But the rest of the cast are good as well. Even Adam Goldberg's in there. You know, we don't really hear of him much now.
Yeah, that's true.
This was before he kind of sort of had his moment.
See, he gets a great line, and I always remember it, is because both him and Amanda Plummer play characters who are suicide, you know, people who are trying to commit suicide, and he sort of brought them back to life on the cusp sort of thing.
Yeah.
But when Adam Goldberg's character actually gets killed, he turns around to Elias Kosolis or something like that. Nice. Goes, thanks, mate, you're a sport, which of course just really weird. It just always stuck with me that, you know.
Really, yeah, I think that works. All that stuff, you know, that he's going, he's got to try and, you know, he gets this scene where he goes to, and he's like, it's really difficult to find someone at just the right point where they're going to die, but you've got to try and keep them, he's going to keep them alive. And he's been doing this for a really long time. And Elias Koteas, I've never quite known how to pronounce his name. Mm. He always looks to me just like a young Robert De Niro. Whenever I see him, he always just
looks
like,
Around this time, he'd already done things like Cyborg 2 with Angelina Jolie.
Yeah,
he was kind of on the way out.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, Ninja Turtles was where I first saw him. But his career kind of never became a big leading man kind of thing. He's always been much more of a character actor.
Yeah, he did a sort of lot of art house stuff, and then ended up on SVU, Special Victims Unit, or Homicide, Law and Order, I think it was. That's where he spent a lot of his time.
Eric Stoltz is interesting casting, because again, he's one of those guys who's, there's a lot of the guys in this you don't really hear much of. I mean, like Amanda Plummer, brilliant. I mean, she turns up towards the end of the movie, going, you know, full on Amanda Plummer, you know, so she's like a Nicolas Cage kind of thing. She always goes these wild sort of kooky kind of performances in everything she was doing in the 90s and that. And you do see her a bit, I think, every now and again. Viggo Mortensen is a pleasant surprise. I mean, he doesn't turn up like Amanda Plummer until the third act. Mm. So you're always watching thinking, has he been in it and gone and I just didn't see him or whatever? But when he turns up, you absolutely know he's there.
Oh, absolutely. So
like, he's like, whoa, he's like bringing this intensity of this, you know, crazed, you know, you know, demonic character. And there's a whole, what I hadn't noticed about it, what I brought to it this time, was thinking how there's kind of a Xavier Magneto kind of relationship going on.
Hmm.
You know, like these people, you know, these characters, these very powerful characters who used to be on the same side, used to be very close, and now they're, you know, something's torn them apart. And, you know, one's willing to kill the other, but there's this slight hesitation.
Yeah,
on the part of the evil one to sort of not do it, because
The fact that he's trying to get the likes of Elias Koteas to do it for him, he doesn't want to get his hands dirty. It's not as if he's got a conscience or anything, but
I like all the mythology and the world building with the angels and the war and you know, talking about they've got this copy of the Bible that's got the 23rd chapter of John, which is not in the current Bible, whatever. And there's these lines like, even now in heaven, there are angels carrying savage weapons and stuff like that. So it's the kind of concept that ultimately more recently has been presented in films like Legion. But didn't really, I mean, even the setting for Legion is very similar.
Yeah,
kind of rural, you know, desert sort of landscape. This one kind of moves locations. You've got like the city stuff, and then you've got the stuff that's set around the school.
Mm-hmm.
And you almost think, you know, would you be able to do that now? Because the whole idea of this little girl and talking to this homeless guy basically in the school, you know, would you be able to? And even when Christopher Walken turns up and he's talking to the kids and he's got the kids on his knee and stuff, you're thinking, that was a different time.
Stranger danger.
I don't think they'd be doing that sort of thing. But, you know, again, Christopher Walken, brilliant in all those scenes. Mm. The whole stuff about Colonel Hawthorne.
Oh, yeah.
And his soul, and hiding the soul in the girl and all that sort of stuff. I thought it was quite interesting stuff. But it really, at the heart of it, I mean, it is those performances. I mean, at the end, when the visual effects kick in, that hasn't aged well.
No.
Anyway. But it is a strong enough, you know, concept and execution that it's still very much one of those must-see straight-to-video movies.
Yep, I totally agree. So we don't score the throwbacks, but we will mention that it's currently available on Amazon Prime. So go check it out if you haven't seen it before. It's definitely worth your time. And that is the end of this particular show. So if you like what you've heard, get in contact with us. You can find us on Facebook as the DTV Digest, also on Twitter at the DTV Digest. And also we have our own email account if you want to sort of send us anything. We are the DTV Digest at gmail.com. So thank you for listening and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.